Welcome to the Penn Faulkner Podcast. I'm Nate Brown, Deputy Director of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. Episode 24 of the podcast features the 2013 Penn Malamud Award Ceremony and Memorial Reading. Each year, the Penn Faulkner Foundation and the Malamud family work to identify a writer who has demonstrated excellence in the short story. The 2013 recipient of the award was George Saunders, whose most recent collection of short fiction, 10th of December, was published in January of 2013. This podcast features a reading by Saunders, held at the Church of the Reformation here in Washington, D.C., on December 6th, 2013, and was followed by the conferral of the 2013 Penn Malamud Award by Jana Malamud Smith.
Thank you so much, Alan. Thank you, Emma. Thank you. And I want to say a special thanks to the Malamud family. It's so wonderful to meet you and also to be even in any way associated with your father's memory. It's a deep honor. He was such a wonderfully funny, humane writer. And I remember as a young student, back before I believed in humor, you know, I liked it in real life, but not in literature, and reading some of his work, and it really was a good wake-up call to understand that humanity and humor are really one and the same. So thanks, everyone, for coming. And I thought I would just read about 25 minutes of a story, and I'm going to clip it off at a critical point so that you'll go and buy it. And in Reading Rainbow, they used to say it was leaving you hanging, so we'll do that. I've been really interested the last few years in this mode that I think of as third-person ventriloquist, where it's a kind of a usual third person, but you just get into the person's head a little quicker and more frankly than you normally would, and you take on the person's diction and flawed thinking and so on. So this story has kind of two narrators. The first one is a little boy. He's kind of a preteen, kind of dorky, maybe like a Dungeons and Dragons kind of a kid. And then the second one is a kind of a middle-aged, 50-ish guy. And the guy, he was... He's sick. He's got a brain tumor. And a couple years ago, someone that I knew got the big diagnosis, you know, and I thought, oh. And, you know, David Mamet has this bit where he says that fictional thinking in its best is almost exactly like spontaneous fantasy. So that thing where you have a little quick revenge fantasy or a rescue fantasy is, in Mamet's view, some of the most authentic fiction making. So when I heard about this friend, I thought, you know, of course, as we all would, what would I do? You know, in the unlikely event that I ever die, what would happen? And really, within a couple seconds, this whole thing, kind of embarrassing thing, unscrolled, which was, first of all, I wouldn't want to suffer. I wouldn't want my family to suffer, so I would just get it over with. Really? Yeah, how? Nothing messy, no cleanup, and I had just been reading Into Thin Air, and I thought, that's the way to do it, because we all know that freezing to death is very easy. And comfortable. So I thought, well, yeah, that's it. You go out into the woods, don't tell anybody, just sit there very nobly, just do a slow fade with a smile on your face. So, and that took about 3 seconds, and I went, oh my God, what was that about? And started to suppress it, and then saw that there was a seed of a story in it. So this is this story, and it's called 10th of December. And then the only other thing you might need to know is there are these things called nethers, which are kind of just these weird space aliens that this little 12-year-old kid invented. Okay, so there we go. That should be all you need to know. This is the first little bit of 10th of December. The pale boy with unfortunate Prince Valiant bangs and cub-like mannerisms hulked to the mudroom closet and requisitioned Dad's white coat. Then requisitioned the boots he'd spray-painted white. Painting the pellet gun white had been a no. That was a gift from Aunt Chloe. Every time she came over, he had to haul it out so she could make a big stink about the wood grain. Today's assignation, walk to pond, ascertain beaver dam. Likely he would be detained by that species that lived amongst the old rock wall. They were small, but upon emerging, assumed certain proportions and gave chase. This was just their methodology. His aplomb threw them. He knew that. And reveled in it. He would turn, level the pellet gun, intone, "Are you aware of the usage of this human implement?" Blam! They were netherworlders, or nethers. They had a strange bond with him. Sometimes for whole days, he would just nurse their wounds. Occasionally for a joke, he would shoot one in the butt as it fled, who henceforth would limp for the rest of its days, which could be as long as an additional 9 million years. Safe inside the rock wall, the shot one would go, "Guys, look at my butt." As a group, all would look at Jizman's butt, exchanging sullen glances of, "Jizman shall indeed be limping for the next 9 million years, poor bloke." Because yes, Nethers tended to talk like that guy in Mary Poppins, which naturally raised some mysteries as to their ultimate origin here on Earth. Detaining him was problematic for the Nethers. He was wily, plus could not fit through their rock wall opening. When they tied him up and went inside to brew their special miniaturizing potion, wham, he would snap their antiquated rope with a move from his self-invented martial arts system, Toy Foy, a.k.a. Deadly Forearms, and place at their doorway an implacable rock of suffocation, trapping them inside. Later, imagining them in their death throes, taking pity on them, he would come back, move the rock. "Blimey," one of them might say from withal. "Thanks, governor, you're indeed a worthy adversary." Sometimes there would be torture. They would make him lie on his back, looking up at the racing clouds while they tortured him in ways he could actually take. They tended to leave his teeth alone, which was lucky. He didn't even like to get a cleaning. They were dunderheads in that manner. They never messed with his peen and never messed with his fingernails. He'd just abide there, infuriating them with his snow angels. Sometimes, believing it their coup de grace, not realizing he'd heard this since time immemorial from certain in-school Cretans, they'd go, "Wow, we didn't even know Robin could be a boy's name," and chortle their nether laughs. Today, he had a feeling that the Nethers might kidnap Suzanne Bledsoe, the new girl in homeroom. She was from Montreal. He just loved the way she talked. So, apparently, did the Nethers, who planned to use her to repopulate their depleted numbers and bake various things they did not know how to bake. All suited up now, NASA, turning awkwardly to go out the door. "Affirmative, we have your coordinates. Be careful out there, Robin." Whoa, cold, dang. Duck thermometer read 10, and that was without windshield. That made it fun. That made it real. A green Nissan was parked where Pool Street dead-ended into the soccer field. Hopefully the owner was not some perv he would have to outwit, or a Nether in the human guise. Bright, bright, blue and cold. Crunch went to snow as he crossed the soccer field. Why did colds such as this give a running guy a headache? Likely it was due to prominent wind speed velocity. The path into the woods was as wide as one human. It seemed the Nethers had indeed kidnapped Suzanne Bledsoe. Damn him and his ilk. Judging by this single set of tracks, the Nether appeared to be carrying her. Foul cad. He'd better not be touching Suzanne inappropriately while carrying her. If so, Suzanne would no doubt be resisting with untamable fury. This was concerning. This was very concerning. When he caught up to him, he would say, "Look, Suzanne, I know you don't know my name, having misaddressed me as Roger. That time you asked me to scoot over. But nevertheless, I must confess, I feel there is something to us. Do you feel the same?" Suzanne had the most amazing brown eyes. They were wet now, with fear and sudden reality. "Stop talking to him, mate," the Nether said. "I won't," he said. "And Suzanne, even if you don't feel there's something to us, rest assured, I will still slay this fellow and return you home. Where do you live again?" "Over in El Ciro, by the water tower. Those are some nice houses back there." "Yes," Suzanne said, "we also have a pool. You should come over this summer. It's cool if you swim with your shirt on." "And also, yes to there being something to us. You are by far the most insightful boy in our class. Even when I take into consideration the boys I knew in Montreal, I am just like, no one can compare." "Well, that's nice to hear," he said. "Thank you for saying that. I know I'm not the thinnest." "The thing about girls," Suzanne said, "is we are more content-driven." "Will you two stop already?" the Nether said, "because now is the time for your deaths. "Well, now is certainly the time for somebody's death," Robin said. The twerpy thing was, you never really got to save anyone. Last summer, there'd been a dying raccoon out here. He'd thought of lugging it home so Mom could call the vet. But up close, it was too scary. Raccoons being actually bigger than they appear in cartoons. And this one looked like a potential biter. So he ran home to get it some water, at least. Upon his return, he saw where the raccoon had done some apparent last-minute thrashing. That was sad. He didn't do well with sad. There had perchance been some pre-weeping by him in the woods. "That just means you have a big heart," Suzanne said. "Well, I don't know," he said modestly. Here was the old truck tire where the high school kids partied. Inside the tire, frosted with snow, were three beer cans and a wadded-up blanket. "You probably like to party," the netter had cracked to Suzanne moments earlier as they passed this very spot. "No, I don't," Suzanne said. "I like to play, and I like to hug." "Hoo boy," the netter said. "Sounds like Dullsville." "Somewhere there is a man who likes to play and hug," Suzanne said. He came out of the woods now to the prettiest vista he knew. The pond was a pure frozen white. It struck him as somewhat Switzerlandish. Someday he would know for sure, when the Swiss threw him a parade or whatnot. Here the nether's tracks departed from the path as if he had contemplatively taken a moment to gaze at the pond. Perhaps this nether was not all bad. Perhaps he was having a debilitating conscience attack vis-a-vis the valiantly struggling Suzanne atop his back. At least he seemed to somewhat love nature. Then the tracks returned to the path, wound around the pond, and headed up Lexo Hill. What was this strange object? A coat on the bench? The bench the nethers used for their human sacrifices? No accumulated snow on coat? Inside of coat still slightly warm? Ergo, the recently discarded coat of the nether. This was some strange juju. This was an intriguing conundrum, if he had ever encountered one, which he had. Once he'd found a bra on the handlebars of a bike. Once he'd found an entire untouched steak dinner on a plate behind Fresno's and hadn't eaten it, though it had looked pretty good. Something was afoot. Then he beheld, halfway up Lexo Hill, a man, a coatless, bald-headed man, super skinny, in what looked like pajamas, climbing plodfully with tortoise patience, bare white arms sticking out of his PJ shirt like two bare white branches sticking out of a PJ shirt. What kind of person leaves his coat behind on a day like this? The mental kind. That was who. This guy looks sort of mental, like an Auschwitz dude or sad, confused grandpa. Dad had once said, "Trust your mind, Rob. If it smells like shit, but has writing across it that says happy birthday and a candle stuck down in it, what is it?" "Is there icing on it?" he'd said. Dad had done that thing of squinting his eyes when an answer was not quite there yet. But what was his mind telling him now? Something was wrong here. A person needed a coat, even if the person was a grown-up. The pond was frozen. The duck thermometer said 10. If the person was mental, all the more reason to come to his aid. As had not, Jesus not said, "Blessed are those who help those who cannot help themselves but are too mental or doddering or have a disability." He snagged the coat off the bench. It was a rescue. A real rescue, at last, sort of. Excuse me. 10 minutes earlier, Don Eber had paused at the pond to catch his breath. He was so tired. What a thing. Holy moly. When he used to walk a Sasquatch out here, they'd do 6 times around the pond, jog up the hill, tag the boulder on top, sprint back down. "Better get moving," said one of two guys who'd been in discussion in his head all morning. "That is, if you're still set on the boulder idea," the other one said, which still strikes us as kind of fancy pants. Seemed like one guy was Dad and the other was Kip Flemish. Stupid cheaters. They switched spouses, abandoned the switched spouses, fled together to California. Had they been gay or just swingers? Gay swingers? The dad and Kip in his head had acknowledged their sins, and the three of them had struck a deal. He would forgive them for being possible gay swingers, and leaving him to do the soapbox derby alone with just mom, and they would consent to giving him some solid manly advice. He wants it to be nice. This was Dad now. It seemed Dad was somewhat on his side. Nice, Kip said. That is not the word I would use. A cardinal zinged across the day. It was amazing, amazing, really. He was young. He was 53. Now he'd never deliver his major national speech on compassion. What about going down the Mississippi in a canoe? What about living in an A-frame near a shady creek with the two hippie girls he'd met in 1968 and that souvenir shop in the Ozarks when Alan, his stepfather, wearing those crazy aviators, had bought him a bag of fossil rocks? One of the hippie girls who said that he, Eber, would be a fox when he grew up, and would he please be sure to call her at that time? Then the hippie girls had put their tawny heads together and giggled at his prospective foxiness. And that had somehow never... Sister Val had said, why not shoot for being the next JFK? So he'd run for class president. Alan, his stepfather, had bought him a styrofoam straw boater. They'd sat together decorating the hatband with magic markers, win with Eber, on the back, groovy. Alan had helped him record a tape of a little speech. Alan had taken that tape somewhere and come back with 30 copies to pass around. Your message is good, Alan had said, and you are incredibly well-spoken. You can do this thing. And he'd done it. He'd won. Alan had thrown him a victory party, a pizza party. All the kids had come. Oh, Alan, kindest man ever, had taken him swimming, had taken him to decoupage, and combed out his hair so patiently that time he came home with lice, never a harsh, et cetera, et cetera. Not so once the suffering began, God damn it. More and more his words askew. More and more his words were not what he would hope. Once the suffering began, Alan had raged, said things no one should say to mom, to Eber, to the guy delivering water. Went from a shy man, always placing a reassuring hand on your back, to a diminished pale figure in a bed, shouting, cunt! Except with some weird New England accent, so it came out, cunt! The first time Alan had shouted, cunt! There followed a funny moment during which he and mom looked at each other to see which of them was being called cunt. But then Alan amended, for clarity, cunts! So it was clear he meant both of them. What a relief. They cracked up. Geez, how long had he been standing here? Daylight was waiting, wasting. I honestly didn't know what to do, but he made it so simple. Took it all on himself. So what else is new? Exactly. This was Jody and Tommy now. Hi, kids. Big day today. I mean, sure, it would have been nice to have had a chance to say a proper goodbye. But at what cost? Exactly. And see, he knew that. He was a father. That's what a father does. Eases the burdens of those he loves. Saves the ones he loves from painful last images that might endure for a lifetime. Soon enough, Alan had become that. And no one was going to fault anybody for avoiding that. Sometimes he and mom would huddle in the kitchen rather than risk incurring the wrath of that. Even that understood the deal. You'd trot in a glass of water, set it down, say very politely, anything else, Alan? And you'd see that thinking, all these years I was so good to you people, and now I am merely that. Sometimes the gentle Alan would be inside there too, indicating with his eyes, look, go away, please go away. I am trying so hard not to call you cunt. Rail thin, ribs sticking out, catheter taped to dick, waft of shit smell. You are not Alan, and Alan is not you. So his wife Molly had said. As for Dr. Spivey, he couldn't say, wouldn't say. Was busy drawing a daisy on a post-it. Then finally said, well, honestly, as these things grow, they can tend to do weird things. But it doesn't necessarily have to be terrible. Had one guy just always craved him a Sprite. And Eber thought, did you, dear Dr. Savior, Lifeline, just say, craved him a Sprite? That's how they got you. You thought, maybe I'll just crave me a Sprite. Next thing you knew, you were that. shouting Kant, shitting your bed, swatting at the people who were scrambling to clean you. No, sir. No, sirree, Bob. Wednesday, he'd fallen out of the med bed again. There on the floor in the dark, it had come to him, I could spare them. Spare us or spare you? Get thee behind me, sweetie. A breeze sent down a sequence of linear snow puffs from somewhere above. Beautiful. Why were we made just so to find so many things that happened every day pretty? He took off his coat. Good Christ. Took off his hat and gloves, stuffed the hat and gloves in the sleeve of the coat, left the coat on the bench. This way, they'd know. They'd find the car, walk up the path, find his coat. It actually was a miracle that he'd gotten this far. Well, he'd always been strong. Once he'd run a half marathon with a broken foot. After his vasectomy, he'd cleaned the garage, no problem. He'd waited in the med bed this morning for Molly to go off to the pharmacy. That was the toughest part, just calling out a normal goodbye. His mind veered toward her now, and he jerked it back with a prayer. Let me pull this off. Lord, let me not fuck it up. Let me bring no dishonor. Let me do it cling. Let me do it cling. Clean. Cleanly. Estimated time of overtaking the nether, handing him his coat, approximately 9 minutes. 6 minutes to follow the path around the pond, an additional 3 minutes to fly up the hillside like a delivering wraith or mercy angel, bearing the simple gift of a coat. Oh, that's just an estimate, NASA. I pretty much made that up. We know that, Robin. We know very well by now how irreverent you work. Like that time you cut a fart on the moon. Or the time you tricked Mel into saying, Mr. President, what a delightful surprise it was to find an asteroid circling Uranus. That estimate was particularly iffy, this nether being surprisingly brisk. Robin himself was not the fastest wicket in the stick. He had a certain girth, which Dad prognosticated would soon triumphantly congeal into linebackerish solidity. He hoped so. For now, he just had the slight man boobs. Robin, hurry, Suzanne said. I feel so sorry for that poor old guy. He's a fool, Robin said, because Suzanne was young and did not yet understand that when a man was a fool, he made hardships for the other men who were less foolish than he. He doesn't have much time, Suzanne said, bordering on the hysterical. They're there, he said, comforting her. I'm just so frightened, she said. And yet he is fortunate to have one such as I to hump his coat up that big-ass hill, which, due to its steepness, is not exactly my cup of tea, Robin said. I guess that's the definition of hero, Suzanne said. I guess so, he said. I don't mean to continue being insolent, she said, but he seems to be pulling away. What would you suggest, he said. Well, with all due respect, she said, and because I know you consider us as equals but different, with me covering the brainy angle and special inventions and whatnot. Yes, yes, go ahead, he said. Well, just working through the math in terms of simple geometry, he saw where she was going with this, and she was quite right. No wonder he loved her. He must cut across the pond, thereby decreasing the ambient angle, ergo trimming valuable seconds off his catch-up time. Wait, Suzanne said, is that dangerous? It is not, he said. I have done it numerous times. Please be careful, Suzanne implored. Well, once, he said. You have such aplomb, Suzanne demurred. Actually, never, he said softly, not wishing to alarm her. Your bravery is irascible, Suzanne said. He started across the pond. It was actually pretty cool walking on water. In summer, canoes floated here. If Mom could see him, she'd have a conniption. Mom treated him like a piece of glass due to his alleged infant surgeries. She went on full alert if he so much as used a stapler. But Mom was a good egg, a reliable counselor and steady hand of guidance. She had a munificent splay of long silver hair and a raspy voice, though she didn't smoke and was even a vegan. She'd never been a biker chick, although some of the in-school Cretans claimed she resembled one. He was actually quite fond of Mom. He was now approximately 3/4, or that would be 60% across. Between him and the shore lay a grayish patch. Here in summer, a stream ran in. Looked a tad iffy. At the edge of the grayish patch, he gave the ice a bonk with the butt of his gun. solid as anything. Here he went. Ice rolled a bit underfoot. Probably it was shallow here. Anyways, he hopes so. Yikes. How's it going? Suzanne said, trepidly. Could be better, he said. Maybe you should turn back, Suzanne said. But wasn't this feeling of fear the exact feeling all heroes had to confront early in life? Wasn't overcoming this feeling of fear what truly distinguished the brave? There could be no turning back. Or could there? Maybe there could. Actually, there should. The ice gave way and the boy fell through. Excuse me. Nausea had not been mentioned in the humbling step. A blissful feeling overtook me as I drifted off to sleep at the base of the crevasse. No fear, no discomfort, only a vague sadness at the thought of all that remained undone. This is death, I thought. It is but nothing. Author, whose name I cannot remember, I would like a word with you. A-hole. The shivering was insane, like a tremor. His head was shaking on his neck. He paused to puke a bit in the snow, white-yellow against a white-blue. This was scary. This was scary now. But every step was a victory. He had to remember that. With every step, he was fleeing father and father, farther from stepfather. What a victory he was wresting from the jaws of defeat. He felt the need at the back of his throat to say it right. From the jaws of defeat. From the jaws of defeat. Oh, Alan, even when you were that, you were still Alan to me. Please know that. Falling, Dad said. For some definite time, he waited to see where he would land and how much it would hurt. Then there was a tree in his gut. He found himself wrapped fetally around some tree. Fuck's sake. Ouch. Ouch, this was too much. He hadn't cried after the surgeries or during the chemo, but he felt like crying now. It wasn't fair. It happened to everyone, supposedly, but now it was happening specifically to him. He kept waiting for some special dispensation, but no. Something someone bigger than him kept refusing. You were told that the big something someone loved you especially, but in the end, you saw it was otherwise. The big something someone was neutral, unconcerned. When it innocently moved, it crushed people. Years ago, with the illuminated body, he and Molly had seen this brain slice. Marring the brain slice had been a nickel-sized brown spot. That brown spot was all it had taken to kill the guy. Guy must have had his hopes and dreams, closet full of pants and so on, some treasured childhood memories, a mob of koi in the willow shade at Gage Park, say, or Graham searching in her Wrigley-smelling purse for a tissue like that. If not for that brown spot, the guy might have been one of the people walking by on the way to lunch in the atrium. But no. He was defunct now, off rotting somewhere, no brain in his head. Looking down at the brain slice, Eber had felt a sense of superiority. Poor guy. He was pretty unlucky what had happened to him. He and Molly had fled to the atrium, had hot scones, watched the squirrel mess with a plastic cup. Wrapped feebly around the tree, Eber traced a scar on his head. Tried to sit up, no dice. Tried to use the tree to sit up. His hand wouldn't close. Reaching around the tree with both hands, joining his hands at the wrists, he pulled himself up, leaned back against the tree. How was that? Fine. Good, actually. Maybe this was it. Maybe this was as far as he got. He'd had it in mind to sit cross-legged against a boulder at the top of the hill, but really, what difference did it make? All he had to do now was stay put. Stay put by force thinking the same thoughts he'd used to propel himself out of the med bed and into the car and across the soccer field and through the woods. Molly, Tommy, Jody huddling in the kitchen filled with pity. Molly, Tommy, Jody recoiling at something cruel he'd said. Tommy hefting his thin torso up in his arms so that Molly, Jody could get under there with the wash rag. Then it would be done. He would have preempted all future debasement. All his fears about the coming months would be mute. Moot. This was it. Was it? Not yet. Soon, though. An hour, 40 minutes. Was he doing this? Really? He was. Was he? Would he be able to make it back to the car, even if he changed his mind? He thought not. Here he was. He was here. This incredible opportunity to end things with dignity was right in his hands. All he had to do was stay put. I will fight no more forever. Concentrate on the beauty of the pond, the beauty of the woods, the beauty you are returning to, the beauty that is everywhere, as far as you can. Oh, for shit's sake. Oh, for crying out loud. Some kid was on the pond. Chubby kid in white with a gun, carrying Eber's coat. You little fart. Put that coat down. Get your ass home. Mind your own. Damn it. Kid tapped the ice with the butt of his gun. You wouldn't want some kid finding you. That could scar a kid. Although, kids found freaky things all the time. Once he found a naked photo of Dad and Mrs. Flemish. That had been freaky. Of course, not as freaky as finding a grimacing cross-legged... Oh, kid was swimming. Swimming was not allowed. That was clearly posted. No swimming. Kid was a bad swimmer. Real thrash fest down there. Kid was creating with his thrashing a rapidly expanding black pool. With each thrash, the kid incrementally expanded the boundary of the black. He was on his way down before he knew he'd started. Kid in the pond, ran repetitively through his mind as he minced. Progress was tree to tree. Standing there panting, you got to know a tree well. This one had three knots, nose. This started out as one tree and became two. Suddenly, he was not purely the dying guy who woke nights in the med bed thinking, make this not true. But again, partly the guy who used to put bananas in the freezer, then crack them on the counter and pour chocolate over the broken chunks. The guy who'd once stood outside a classroom window in a rainstorm to see how Jody was faring with that little redheaded shit who wouldn't give her a chance at the book table. The guy who used to hand paint bird feeders in college and sell them on weekends in Boulder, wearing a jester hat and doing a little juggling routine. He started to fall again, caught himself, froze in a hunched over position, then hurtled forward, fell flat on his face, chucked his chin on a root. You had to laugh. You almost had to laugh. He got up, got doggedly up, his right hand presented as a bloody glove. Tough nuts, too bad. Once in football, a tooth had come out. Later in the half, Eddie Blandick had found it. He'd taken it from Eddie, flung it away. That had also been him. Here was the switch bank. It wasn't far now. Switch back. What to do when he got there? Get kid out of pond, get kid moving, force walk kid through woods, across soccer field to one of the houses on pool. If nobody home, pile kid into Nissan, crank up heater, drive to Our Lady of Sorrows, urgent care, fastest route to urgent care, 50 yards to the trailhead, 20 yards to the trailhead. Thank you, God, for my strength. And I'll stop there.
Thanks for joining us, and stay tuned for upcoming events here in Washington, D.C. that will also be produced for future episodes of this podcast. Upcoming events feature authors including D.T. Max, Ayanna Mathis, Justin Torres, Amy Tan, Deborah Tannen, and Richard Ford, among others. If you're in D.C., you can call the Folger box office to get your tickets. They're at 202-544-7077. We want to thank our reading series underwriters for their support. Thank you to Hill's Kitchen, a specialty kitchen store here in D.C.'s Eastern Market neighborhood, and online at www.hillskitchen.com. To Aegean Arts Circle, which each summer provides small intensive writing workshops with private time to write in Andros, Greece. Find them online at www.aegeanartscircle.com. Thanks also to New York University's MFA program in creative writing and their new low residency MFA Writers Workshop in Paris. Find more info at cwp.as.nyu.edu. Thanks also to Sonoma Restaurant here in D.C., where they feature some of the Mid-Atlantic's best naturally raised and local ingredients paired with the best American and Italian wines. Find more at sonomadc.com. A special thanks to the Malamud family, including Janet Malamud Smith, Paul Malamud, and David Smith, for their continued support for the collaboration that makes the Penn Malamud Award possible. Thanks also to Benedict Cupstis, who composed and performed the music used in this episode. Find out more about Penn Faulkner and our mission to build the next generation of readers at www.pennfaulkner.org and help us fulfill that mission by making a charitable contribution today.